invitation to join you and to be with so many other practice innovators really trying to make care better in the trenches of day-to-day care, and that's where it belongs. I wrote a piece in the New England Journal with a colleague at the Stoeckle Center for Primary Care called Shared Decision Make the Pinnacle of Patient-Centered Care. And, you know, there's maybe a temptation to always say the thing you're working on is the pinnacle, but I would argue that there are many really important forms of patient engagement that I know all of you are working on. But when patients are facing a fateful decision where there's more than one reasonable thing to do, I'd argue that's the key time where they need to be informed and involved, because it's really their involvement that leads to working with you the best decision. And I'll sort of lay out that argument here. So just a word about our foundation. We're a not-for-profit foundation based in Boston. Our mission is to inform and amplify the patient's voice in healthcare decisions. Now, that involves not only helping the patient speak up in the left panel, but also increasing the acuity of the healthcare system to listen to the patient voice. Because from my perspective, nothing would be more tragic to have an informed and involved patient coming into a clinician's office or a hospital and hitting a brick wall. So we need to work together on both sides of the equation. Like many of you, we think patients should be supported and encouraged to participate in their healthcare decisions, fully informed with accurate, unbiased, and understandable information, and respected by having their goals and concerns honored. In terms of a disclosure, our foundation has a relationship with a company called Health Dialogue that provides royalty and contract funding to develop and maintain decision support materials, decision aids, and I'll say a word about that later, but that lets us at the foundation have a strict conflict of interest policy, so the staff, including myself, our medical editors who make final decisions about our content, are prohibited from any financial support from the drug and device industry. That's really important because as patients go to the internet these days to look up information, it's surprising and striking how much of that information comes from sources that really have a bias about whether patients choose, if you will, treatment A versus treatment B. So what's the problem we're trying to address with shared decision making? And I'd start with asking the question, is informed consent real? Because it's informed consent that we've traditionally used when patients face healthcare decisions to make sure they're informed about what we're doing to them, if you will, in an increasingly complicated medical world. And let me go back more than 10 years to a study done by Eric Holmboe and colleagues at Yale, where he surveyed consecutive patients who were scheduled for elective coronary revascularization at Yale New Haven Hospital in the late 1990s. And he basically asked these people, why are you doing it? And 75% thought a percutaneous coronary intervention, generally stenting at that time, would prevent a myocardial infarction, and 71% thought it would help them live longer. Now, in the late 1990s, that might have been reasonable to believe because we haven't built up the storehouse of medical evidence on this question that we have now. In fact, by 2009, there was a meta-analysis of 61 studies involving over 25,000 patients. The bottom line, sequential innovations in catheter-based treatment for non-acute coronary artery disease, that is, stable angina, showed no evidence of an effect on myocardial death or myocardial infarction when compared to medical therapy. And as I think many of you know, there have been three recent meta-analyses in 2012 and 2013 looking at subsequent information in trials published since 2009 that have confirmed the same conclusion. So, how are patients doing now in terms of their knowledge about procedures? Well, Michael Rothberg at Bay State Medical Center in Massachusetts essentially repeated the Holmboe study right about the time the Trinkelos meta-analysis was published. So a survey of consecutive patients consented for elective coronary angiography and possible stenting in 2007-2008. Now, 88% thought their percutaneous coronary intervention was going to prevent an MI. 76% thought it would help them live longer. Now, essentially the same numbers as over a decade earlier, despite all that evidence and all those thousands of patients contributing to the conclusion that while there are important things that a percutaneous coronary intervention can do, like reduction in angina, some improvement in functional status, it's really not about preventing MIs or making people live longer. So people are misunderstanding the basic purpose for the intervention most of the time. So is that unique to the issue of percutaneous coronary interventions? Although it's a good example, we had done a random digit dial telephone survey with colleagues at the University of Michigan, a probability sample of US adults over 40, English speaking in this case, and we were looking for people who had made one of nine different decisions in the past 2 years. We had a response rate of 51%, not bad for telephone surveys these days. We were looking for people who within the last 2 years had made a decision about surgery, either back surgery, knee or hip replacement, cataract extraction, cancer screening, tests that can often get one on a slippery slope of more intervention, prostate cancer screening, colorectal cancer screening, breast cancer screening, or a decision about going on a medication for hypertension, hyperlipidemia, or depression. I'll just say, many of you have been reading, as I have on the plane coming out, trying to come to grips with the new ACC, American Heart Association recommendations on lipid management. There's a lot of shared decision making in there, maybe not as much information as we need of how to make it real for people in the trenches. So these, in fact, are common decisions. And although there are many interesting findings in the survey, one of the things we did was actually we asked patients who had actually made a decision for one of these conditions in the last 2 years, could they correctly identify the four or five key gist facts about the procedure that or the test or treatment that prior patients and clinical experts thought they should know before making a decision. And in fact, as we asked respondents the questions relevant to their decision, for 8 out of the 10 decisions, fewer than half of our respondents could get more than one knowledge question right. So like the situation with coronary revascularization, across a spectrum of interventions, including surgery, medicines, screening tests, pretty low levels of knowledge, raising questions about informed consent. Just to give you an example, this was people who had undergone hip or knee replacement in the last 2 years, and we asked questions like, what's the probability of getting pain relief from joint replacement surgery? Not an exact number, but a pretty broad band. It turns out the right answer is greater than 85% from the outcomes research. 28% of people could get that right. What's the chance of a surgical complication? We gave them examples like a wound infection. The correct answer is about between 1 and 10%. 46% of people could get that right. What's the probability replacement will last 20 years or more? Very few people could get that right. How long does it take to return to normal activities? Again, these are all facts that there's good outcomes data on. About 39% of people could get that right. And it's for those wondering about answers, it's a little longer for knee replacement, as you probably know, than hip replacement. 2 to 4 months for knee for hips and 4 to 6 months for knees. So now what I've been talking about thus far is transfer of information from the clinical world to the patient world. What are my options from the patient's perspective? What are the outcomes of those options, and how likely is it that those things will happen to me? But there's an equally important transfer of information from the patient world to the clinical world about what people care about, what's important to them. And let me just highlight that, and I'm going to use the example of decisions about early-stage breast cancer treatment, where the great majority of women have a choice between mastectomy and lumpectomy plus radiation. Lots of randomized trials that tell us that the mortality outcomes are exactly the same from those two interventions, but obviously very different implications in terms of, say, keeping or losing the breast, having a higher risk with lumpectomy plus radiation of a ipsilateral in-breast recurrence. Doesn't seem to influence mortality, but there's a little higher chance you may have to face breast cancer again down the line with that choice, having to go through the radiation for a prolonged period of time, maybe with lumpectomy needing multiple operations to get clear margins before the lumpectomy stops. So in this study, Karen Sapuka and colleagues asked experienced breast cancer clinicians, both doctors and nurses, both men and women, what do you think patients will put in the would list as their top three concerns in making a decision about the choice between lumpectomy and radiation or mastectomy? And so for providers, 71% thought women would put keeping the breast as one of the top three considerations. Living as long as possible, virtually all clinicians thought patients would put that in the top three considerations. Looking natural without clothes, about 80% of clinicians thought patients would put that in the top three considerations in making a decision. And none of them thought the issue of avoiding the hassle of a breast prosthesis would be something that women would put in the top three. Now, you can probably guess what's coming next. What happens when you ask the patients? Well, you get a different story. 7% of women put keeping or losing the breast as a top three consideration in making the choice, while living as long as possible, and remember, these are procedures that have essentially the same cancer outcomes in terms of mortality, not quite as ubiquitous among patients as among clinicians about mortality being in the top three, looking natural among clothes, without clothes, less common listed in the top three than clinicians thought. And maybe my favorite example was about a third of women said, the issue of dealing with a breast prosthesis is one of my top three concerns, where no clinicians thought that was going to be the case. So what you see here is a disconnect in information transfer from the patient world to the clinical world about what people care about. I find myself as a clinician, even though I keep reminding myself how easy it is to assume that people think like us or that our preferences would be the same as their preferences. You don't really know until you ask, and we've got lots of research data like this that suggests that that's really the case. Now, Al Mulley, one of the founders of our foundation, and his colleagues had put this in terms of diagnosis of patient preferences, and there was a report for the King's Fund in the United Kingdom called Patients' Preferences Matter, Stop the Silent Misdiagnosis. The quote there is, many doctors aspire to excellence in diagnosing disease. Far fewer, unfortunately, aspire to the same standards of excellence in diagnosing what patients want. I do think in primary care, where we have longitudinal relationships with people over time, as opposed to, say, those breast cancer experts who are often meeting people for the first time around an acute set of medical decisions, say, related to breast cancer, that we have a leg up, but I suspect we're not perfect either. So, I want to trace this back to the phenomenon of geographic practice variation. The Dartmouth Atlas for years has been looking at rates of interventions for different procedures, spending on end-of-life care, number of medical consultations, say, in the last 6 months of life, and creates these so-called turnip plots on the right, each one being a different hospital service area, and showing that there's often incredible variation, this in rates of coronary artery bypass surgery in the United States. And people have puzzled for a long time what underlies these rates. It's been hard to show that they're either related to outcomes or that patient preferences or their medical conditions vary enough from region to region that explain much of this variation. There are things like socioeconomic status that explain some of it, but not very much of it. One hypothesis, and I'll present some data in a little bit, that makes me think that maybe this is a hypothesis we'll eventually prove, is that two phenomena, patients making decisions in what I'll call the face of avoidable ignorance, in other words, they could know if we communicated enough information about options and outcomes to them, but they don't in standard care. And then clinicians maybe being less than optimal compared to what we could be in diagnosing patient preferences may be supporting this problem of what I'll call poor decision quality and unwanted practice variation. And can, if we inform and involve patients more, we find the question that's begged in the so-called turnip plots in the Dartmouth Atlas. Supposedly they look like turnips. I was born in the city, I don't know. But I get them mashed. But the question that those plots beg is, what's the right rate? And can, by involving patients, we figure out what the right rate for some of these interventions are? So if we step back for a second and think about what's good medical care, it's not just about doing things right. When I presented the coronary artery bypass variation, there was an outlier way on the top, you may have noticed. This was an older slide. That was Redding, California. And some of you remember that in Redding there was a lot of intervention for minimal amounts of coronary disease, making them a real outlier. Now, their report card on outcomes of coronary interventions would have been quite good. It's the darn coronary disease that creates the complications. If you intervene on people who don't need it, you can make things look pretty good afterwards. But that's not good medical care. It's not just about doing things right, although that's important. It's about doing the right thing. And what shared decision-making addresses is what I'll call preference-sensitive care. As I think you'd agree, for many and perhaps most medical problems, there's more than one reasonable option. Now, bacterial meningitis needs antibiotics. A fractured hip, in almost all cases, needs surgery. And getting about doing those things while explaining to patients what we're doing is the right thing to do. But in fact, for many things, like the breast cancer treatment choice or the choice of medical therapy versus coronary revascularization, there are more than one reasonable option. And that's what shared decision making is designed to address. So in thinking about this as a potential antidote for the problem of unwanted practice variation, I'll just go through the process. So key characteristics of the shared decision-making model, this is defined by Kathy Charles and colleagues. At least two participants, the clinician and patient, are involved. But increasingly these days, clinicians have a team that's involved on the clinician side, and patients invite people who care about them, friends, family, et cetera, to be the team on their side. So it may be two teams interacting, but at minimum, it's the patient and the clinician. Both parties share information, and that is what makes shared decision-making a step beyond what we've traditionally done in terms of patient education. Patient education is the one-way transfer of information, but we're talking about two-way transfer information, including that information about preferences and values back to the clinical world. Both parties take steps to build a consensus about the preferred treatment. So this is not turning it over to the patient, leaving them on their own after giving them the information. It's giving the information and then working together to make a good decision and then reaching an agreement on the treatment to implement. Now, patient decision aids can help. These are tools designed to help people participate in decision making. They provide information on the options and help patients clarify and communicate the values they associate with different features of the options. I want to quickly say, though, shared decision-making is the process of clinicians and patients working together to make better decisions. Decision aids aren't shared decision-making. They're just tools to make shared decision-making more practical in the day-to-day world of clinical practice, where no one seems to have enough time. There are many different decision support tools. We've worked on tools that describe a specific condition, present information organized around those decisions. We strive to keep information accessible in terms of charts and graphs. It turns out, I'll show you some evidence, that decision aids that include quantitative information about risk presented in ways that people with limited literacy and numeracy can understand them increase people's accuracy at estimating risk, knowing what the risk means to them. For example, the things in the ACC, AHA, new lipid guideline. Encourage patients to interpret information in context of their own goals and concerns. We engage viewers with real patient stories and advise patients to make decisions with their clinicians. Now, just as there are meta-analyses of trials of, say, coronary revascularization, there are randomized trials of using a shared decision-making approach supported by decision aids, and there's a Cochrane review of decision aids. The last published one, published in 2011, summarized 86 trials from 6 countries, 34 different decisions, and use of decision aids to support shared decision-making led to greater knowledge, more accurate risk perceptions, as I said, lower decisional conflict for patients, greater participation in decision-making, and at the end of the day, fewer people remaining undecided. I'll say that at the International Shared Decision-Making meetings, which were just held recently, this was updated. There are now 119 trials, essentially confirming the same outcomes with narrower confidence intervals. This may be one of the most underutilized interventions with so many randomized trials, and I'm going to lead into the fact that that means implementation, like so many things that you're all wrestling with, is where the real challenge lies. Now, one thing that has created some interest is that there's been a lot of concern that if we give patients more control in decision-making, that they'll just always want more stuff. But that's actually not what the randomized trials show. So in terms of 11 trials that use decision aids around major elective surgery decisions, overall, and this is the forest plot, and at the bottom of the forest plot, if I can point here, I'll just paint the word picture. There was a 21% reduction associated with the use of shared decision making supported by decision aids across these studies. Now, I want to highlight two studies, though, to point out in particular. You can see there's some heterogeneity of effect. If we look at the fourth trial from the top, which I believe is the Morgan study, and what you see is the confidence interval, although broad, is to the right. It suggests an increase in surgical interventions with that particular intervention. And then there's a Berry trial somewhere, about the fourth from the bottom, myself in younger days, which doing a trial with a reduction in surgical rates. It turns out those were both focused on the choice of surgery for benign enlargement of the prostate, BPH. The trial we did was done in the United States, where baseline rates were relatively high, and when we used a decision aid, rates dropped. The trial at the top was done in the United Kingdom, where baseline surgical rates were quite low, and informing patients actually increased the rates. They actually about met in the middle. So that question of, by involving patients, can we find the right rate of doing things, that's a seductive bit of information. We need a lot more trials, though, to nail that down. This is not fundamentally about doing less of things. It's about trying to find the right thing, one patient at a time. Now, as you know, these days there seems to be a chorus of voices calling for more shared decision-making, whether from professional societies like the AMA, the American Board of Internal Medicine, the AAFP, in fact, has made statements in favor. You now see practice guidelines coming from professional societies, including the new HAACC lipid recommendations talking about shared decision-making, and both the urologic societies even suggesting shared decision-making as the way to go for PSA testing. In the past, saying, thou shalt do it, to saying, thou shalt discuss it. That's an evolution from my perspective. So what about the challenge of implementation? Well, that's the key. Our foundation has been working with a network of demonstration sites, including places like the Oregon Rural Practice-Based Research Network, small, often usually family practices in Oregon State, my own hospital at Mass General, all trying to figure out, how do we work this into the workflow of day-to-day healthcare? At my institution, for example, we're using our electronic medical record to prescribe decision support. There are icons reminding clinicians and their office staff, because they've got an important role on the healthcare team, when there are decision support tools available for particular conditions. And we've developed things like six steps to shared decision-making, inviting the patient to participate, presenting options, providing information on benefits and risks, assisting the patient in evaluating options based on their goals and concerns, facilitating deliberation and decision-making, and assisting with implementation. I can't spend a lot of time on this, but I'll just say that that first step, inviting people to participate, may be the most important one. As you know, many patients will come in assuming that for a particular medical problem, there's one right thing to do, and the person who went to medical school or nursing school should know it and should tell them what to do. And in some cases, like bacterial meningitis, that's the right answer. But so many times, there's more than one reasonable option. And starting out by saying, you know, this is a problem where there are a couple of reasonable things we could do, And I'd love you to be part of that decision, because if I know what you care about, we can make a better decision together. It turns out a researcher named Dominic Frosch did an interesting set of focus groups. This was published in Health Affairs in the San Francisco area with a pretty well-educated patient population, and asked the question, if your doctor is going in a direction with a decision that's a little uncomfortable to you, how easy is it to sort of push back and ask questions? Well, it's really hard, even for that relatively empowered group of people. They're desperately afraid of being labeled a bad patient, so that invitation from the clinician to be part of the decision, I think, is a key first step. Now, I just want to, as I close here, present a couple of slides about, can we replicate the kind of findings that were seen in the Cochrane Review of Randomized Trials in real day-to-day practice? What this slide is think of it as a dose response curve for shared decision making. These were people who were prescribed a decision support intervention, including a decision aid, and we asked them across the horizontal axis, how much did you interact with it? Low level, medium level, high level. You can see that most people actually interact at a pretty high level. And then we actually measure knowledge, those just knowledge questions afterwards. And what you see is that you get the same increment of knowledge with more interaction with the decision support tool that are actually seen in the randomized trials with exposure or non-exposure to the decision aid. More importantly, if you stratify by age, because many people say, you know, maybe this approach is all right for college professors, but what about regular people? Is it accessible there? So if we stratify by age here, what you see is older people start with lower knowledge, but in fact can have a quite impressive slope in terms of knowledge gains and actually can get up to where some younger people are with the information at the end of the day. Similarly, if we stratify by educational level, not a great proxy for literacy, but to some degree, what you see is, again, people with less than a high school education start with lower knowledge. They end with lower knowledge, but you can get a similar slope and a similar gain in knowledge with this kind of intervention. Importance ratings. Again, blue is extremely very, somewhat not at all, pretty low in terms of the overall ratings, with, again, about 85% of people saying this is an extremely or very important intervention overall. But what's more important is we stratify by age, if we stratify by educational level, if we stratify by gender, you see pretty similar ratings suggesting this is pretty accessible overall. We need more information as we get to groups with different races and ethnicities. There are challenges communicating information across those spectrums, but I think challenges we're up to, and we have to do it either with our shared decision-making tools or behind closed doors in our offices. Decision role preferences, because we'll often hear from clinicians, my patients don't want this. They want me to tell them what to do. And as I mentioned, often when they first come through the door, that's the case. But as we educate them about shared decision-making and involve them, we're finding these days that in terms of people who either want to make the decision themselves or both equally, that's the great majority of folks, people who want the doctor to make the decision at the end of the day. Once we've informed them in the context of a preference-sensitive decision, we're finding roughly 5% of people are giving us that response. And again, whether we stratify by age, educational level, or gender, pretty much the same picture. Now, effect on decisions is context-specific. For example, we have decision aids on colorectal cancer screening that present the options not only of screening or not screening in the case of colonoscopy, but as you know, how to screen. Is it colonoscopy? Is it some form of fecal occult blood testing? And there are actually randomized trials showing that if you present people more options, you get higher screening rates. Sometimes doctors favor just colonoscopy, but it turns out that presenting just one option may not be the right way to maximize screening rates. And in fact, in our study, if you look at the people who are not sure in the orange, the 23% after interacting with a colorectal cancer screening decision aid, you see people getting off the fence, just 15% undecided. And this was actually before circling back to the clinician at the end of the day. And screening rates, people deciding in favor of screening, actually increasing. But for PSA testing, where I might argue the evidence is weaker, you see the people getting off the fence in the direction of not screening. In other words, the blue goes from 26% to 46%. So effect on decisions is very much context specific. Just in terms of the issue of resource use, I'll just quickly present two studies in closing. Our colleagues at Health Dialogue had actually incorporated decision support tools into a health plan intervention of telephonic coaching, and actually found that in introducing more intensive telephonic coaching, including prescription of decision aids, they found a reduction in total medical costs and about a 10% reduction in hospitalization, mostly for preference-sensitive conditions. And just recently, colleagues of ours at Group Health, a prepaid health plan in the Washington state area that many of you are familiar with, they've been introducing patient decision aids for many conditions and reported in Health Affairs the results in terms of hip and knee arthroplasty. And what they found is that over 6 months, even in a place that started with relatively low rates by U.S. standards, a reduction in knee and hip replacements and lower costs. Although I'll caution you that this was six-month data. You really need longer-term data, because some people who may decide that I'd rather wait will come back later when the time is right for them. There'll be costs associated with that, but picking the right time is just as important as deciding whether or not you want something up front. And maybe the largest implementation study going on now is a Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation Grant, the High Value Health Care Collaborative, engaging patients to meet the triple aim. It's being run out of the Dartmouth Institute. And this involves 16 member systems serving 50 million folks, deploying a new type of healthcare personnel, a patient and family activator. I know many of you are using coaches and specially trained people in your offices to help with quality improvement and patient engagement, and that strategy is using patient decision aids for both chronic conditions like diabetes and heart failure, as well as back surgery and hip and knee arthroplasty, looking at quality and cost as outcomes. So I'll stop there, and thank you for your attention, and I'm really eager to get your questions and a sense of how would this fit into kind of efforts you're doing in patient engagement. Thank you very much.